Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Zephyr Teachout, Fordham law professor and author of Break 'em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money, joins me to discuss the downfall of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and why it was long overdue.
And David Sirota of the Daily Poster will be filling in for Heather Digby Parton this week as we look back on the week in news.
Hey, don't forget you can support this program by going to ROFpodcast.com and becoming a member. It's your support that makes this show possible. And once you become a member, we give you extra content every week. This week, an interview I did some time ago with Professor Frederick Wary. He wrote part of a report for the Roosevelt Institute with three other co-authors. It is a study into the progressive nature of college debt forgiveness. Recent reports are out there saying that this is a regressive measure, that it only helps wealthy people or people who will be wealthy. Well, this is a real eye-opening report, and particularly coming on the heels of a report this past week that's showing that college debt has actually created more wealth disparity between white people and black people in this country, because black people simply do not get as much value out of college degrees. However, they have been taking on more debt in part and largely because of what is revealed in this report by Frederick Wary, that wealth disparity is really the way to measure these type of things. Check it out. You can become a member at ROFpodcast.com. So Heather Parton is out this week, missing an incredibly dynamic week in politics. But joining me is someone who is a tremendous student of politics and political news. And couldn't be happier to be joined by David Sirota. He is the founder and editor of the Daily Poster, which I got to say is my is a daily read for me, David. So it's a real treat for me to have you here today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with something that is an appendage to the sort of the national politics that we have that are going on in some respect, because I see there is a dynamic that's happening in Washington with the infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill. And frankly, what's going on with COVID and the failure of the voting rights bill to pass this week, and Donald Trump. And then, of course, the IPCC report just highlighting some of the horrible sort of natural disaster we're having this week in extreme temperatures and whatnot. But Andrew Cuomo, and for people like you and I, who see the value of the Democratic Party as a mechanism in which to, without a doubt, a flawed one. But there is a duopoly in this country, and one can spend one's time trying to fight that, or one can try and sort of turn it to one's advantage, I guess, on some level, although sometimes it'll look very hard. But for guys like you and I, Andrew Cuomo has been a real problem, representing a larger problem in the Democratic Party in some respects. And I feel like you and I have been talking about Andrew Cuomo for at least a decade. He's only been governor now for, he's not going to quite make it to his full 12 years. But just give me your thoughts on this week. I mean, there are so many things that you and I feel, I think, that he could have been booted out of office for, but should have been voted out of office for by Democratic voters. And yet it ultimately turns out to be something that was his personal or behavior or his, that ends up doing it.
Well, look, Andrew Cuomo, in resigning over what he resigned over, To be honest, he kind of got off without being punished for what he should have been punished for. The fact is that there were a number of corruption scandals. There was the COVID nursing home scandal that costs thousands and thousands of lives. And he was not prosecuted or impeached over those things. Now, obviously, the report that Tish James issued about his sexual predatory behavior. Those are very, very serious charges. It's very, very bad what he did, and it's very, very good that he had to resign over those charges. But the point is we have to also understand what the Democratic Party and Democratic voters were still willing to tolerate. And that's what's kind of disturbing after this, that Andrew Cuomo helped normalize a kind of lawlessness and corruption that will remain normalized as he leaves. Because, I mean, as an example, we did a lot of reporting on the nursing home situation. And the takeaway from the nursing home situation was, here was a guy who buried the data about a nursing home massacre, who helped his donors get legal immunity, his nursing home industry donors get legal immunity from lawsuits for the behavior that they engaged in during the pandemic. And he did it, it appears, in part so that he could get a $5 million book deal for himself touting his leadership. Now, the fact that that went unimpeached, unprosecuted, basically says that the Democratic machine in New York and the law enforcement apparatus of the country just doesn't necessarily see that as an impeachable or prosecutable set of offenses. Now, to be clear, that we may see a difference in that. I mean, the U.S. attorney may still get involved in that and the like. But up until now, that has now been normalized. And you ask the question then, well, what does it mean that that's normalized? And why was it normalized? And I think the answer is that if you start scandalizing and prosecuting those transgressions, to put it mildly, a lot of people are involved in those transgressions and those wrongdoings. There are Democratic legislators in New York who were part of that. The money from the healthcare industry that helped create that legal liability law. I mean, that money was spread all over Albany. And so what you see is a political system that is willing to normalize a kind of systemic form of corruption, but at least in the Democratic Party is willing to punish an individual's in sexually inappropriate behavior. Now, that's better than the Republicans, right? The Republicans will give you systemic corruption and sexual predators and do nothing about it. So that's certainly, the Democrats are better than the Republicans, but we should, there really is a takeaway here of what the Democratic Party machine and its voters are willing to tolerate when it comes to corruption and lawlessness.
Absolutely. And there is a failure and a seemingly lack of interest in dealing with the sort of the structural structural problems we have and you know that are that seemingly are endemic to our politics. You guys did a story on the Democrats in the House, including Nancy Pelosi, who received a bunch of donations as they were allowing. And you know, one could argue, okay, it was more the president's responsibility in terms of you know, extending the eviction moratorium, but the silence from the House also set that situation up. Now, we should say Cori Bush and some members of the squad really drew attention to this and made the White House pay a political price. But this is something that could have been anticipated. Like, you know, Nancy Pelosi could have had a press conference 2 or 3 weeks earlier and said, we've heard what the Supreme Court has said. We know that, you know, we can see the iceberg and we're driving the ship and I'm looking over at the captain. The captain doesn't seem to be moving the wheel. And I just want to say, like, hey, captain, you got to move the wheel because we're headed for an iceberg. And they didn't do it. And part of that, I don't know, you know, it's hard to say that there's a quid pro quo and this and that, but they got rewarded for it.
Well, look, money, we have to understand that money buys not just votes and legislation. Money often can buy a lack of urgency, right? That let's really That's the kind of thing that ties together what we saw vis-a-vis Andrew Cuomo and the nursing home scandal and the House Democrats not moving urgently to enact that eviction moratorium while they were getting real estate money. That the money from the healthcare industry, the nursing home industry to Cuomo, the money from the real estate industry to the House Democrats plays a role in buying a lack of urgency of the political system in doing the things that are necessary. A Democratic Party that was urgent about the eviction ban would have done exactly what you said.
Yep.
But the Democratic Party is constantly trying to find, frankly, a middle ground between what needs to be done and what the donors want done. Now, again, the Democratic Party is better than the Republican Party. But I'll be the first to tell you that the Democratic Party is a weapon of change. It's like bringing a blunt spoon to a knife fight.
Right.
I mean, that's basically what it is. But the problem is, of course, is that we're on a ticking clock when it comes to issues like an eviction moratorium, right? 60 days, 30, whatever it is. We're on a ticking clock when it comes to climate change, right? That you've got to get that blunt spoon to do absolutely everything it can do, even though you acknowledge it's not really a fair fight and the duopoly itself is really a part of the problem. But when you're on such a short timetable, right. I mean, we're talking about days, weeks, months that can mean the difference between hundreds, if not thousands of lives.
Yep. And just as we were talking about this, I remember you guys also did a piece on the fracking that also made its way into part of the infrastructure bill, you know, and the infrastructure bill that Joe Biden had initially proposed was far more aggressive in terms of climate change. And that was blunted. And, you know, through one lens, we'll see what happens with the reconciliation bill, the $3.5 trillion one. But we still have a lot of things that need to be addressed. That even if that $3.5 trillion bill gets passed, which would be extraordinary, and is certainly no guarantee, need to be addressed. Like this week, I can tell you that today, I was trying to scramble to figure out how to get somebody to pick up my kid because his camp, which is outdoors, we got an email this morning. We're going to have to close early because of the heat. And it's like, oh, like this is happening across the country. We don't have a lot of time here.
No, I mean, I'm coming to you from Denver, Colorado, where we have had the worst air quality in the entire world in the last few weeks because of a mix of ozone that comes from fracking and oil and gas emissions and wildfire smoke from climate intensified wildfires. And you exist in that cloud. You and your family exists in a heat emergency. And then you look to Washington and you see not only a lack of urgency, not only, you know, sort of this grindingly slow process in the face of a red alert emergency, but you saw this week, 7 Democrats joining with all Republicans to vote. Now, granted, it was a non-binding measure, but to go on record voting to ban the government from banning fracking. That happened 24 hours after the IPCC's report, which specifically warned about methane emissions linked in a very serious way to fracking. 24 hours later, the members of the Senate, 57 members of the Senate, went on record voting to try to prohibit the government from banning fracking now or in the future. That is not only a lack of urgency, it's either climate denial or ecocidal sociopathy, right? I mean, it is just complete insanity for that to happen. And that happened. And it happened because oil and gas money has poured into the political process, into the political system, and because these lawmakers do not feel a fear of being voted out of office for what they're doing.
I want to just touch on this because it's a good opportunity to transition to talking about the infrastructure bill, the reconciliation just before the break. But you're talking about this is during the Voterama where the reconciliation bill, which is the budget resolution under the rules of this, it opens up the floor essentially in the Senate to where anybody can offer an amendment to the bill. And it is generally something that is an opportunity for both parties, when they're on the wrong side of this reconciliation bill, to offer amendments that they are hoping will give them leverage in the coming elections. And you mentioned the fracking vote, and I want to talk about some of the other votes on the other side of the break, but it is non-binding. And why is it non-binding? Simply because they can go into committee and it just strip it right out.
Basically, the amendment says, hey, budget committee, we want you to do this. Now, the budget committee chairman happens to be Bernie Sanders, and the budget committee chairman can simply ignore it. But I still think that these votes are important because they're saying what our politics values and doesn't value, what people fear, what they don't fear, what they're willing to vote for and vote against. And again, 24 hours after that IPCC report, 57 senators, 50 Republicans, 7 Democrats went on record to try to, at least as a statement, saying we want to prohibit the government from banning fracking. I mean, that's mind-boggling.
I couldn't agree with you more. And as evidence of the impact of that vote, and again, it is a non-binding resolution. It is not going to change policy, which is also not to say that, like, we don't have a problem with, we have a problem with fracking to begin with. Like, if there was a vote to be taken, there should have been one that involved, like, banning fracking.
Yes.
But so put that aside for a moment, just sort of the absence of any legislation that would inhibit fracking is in and of itself a problem. But to illustrate the power of that vote, that non-binding vote, the value of it to the fracking industry, to have bipartisan support for protecting that industry. It's the same thing when Cory Booker went up and made his speech about defunding the police, and was so, exuberant at the opportunity to vote against or to vote with the Republicans on a non-binding resolution to say that any city that defunds the police, which is a sort of a nebulous term, would lose funding. Again, that is, you know, it, I can understand from a political standpoint what the value was to Cory Booker and to the Republicans. You can't use this defund the police against us. But if it has that value in that instance, then it has that value in the other instance with the fracking, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, they understand what they're doing here. They understand the terrain that it creates. And particularly in the context of climate change, this is an all hands on deck moment. Like, you can't have any wavering where 12% of the Democratic caucus is like, yeah, fracking, we should do it. I mean, that's
the crazy part. And I got to tell you something, as somebody from Colorado, what's so mind-boggling to me is that we're sitting here in Colorado choking on the air, being warned to stay inside. And it is a blue state. And our two Democratic senators are back in Washington as 2 of 7 Democrats voting with the Republicans, essentially as a statement to defend fracking. Fracking has grown out of control here in Colorado. It is just kind of, and to say that those senators probably will not be punished by voters. And I should add that the local media out here hasn't even mentioned it. So, I mean, there's like problem on top of problem on top of problem. And look, our role in the media is to try to get that information out there. And I frankly think, not to get off on too much of a tangent, but I frankly think the fact that media doesn't report these things in the terms that they need to be reported then feeds into an electorate that does not hold accountable lawmakers who do these kinds of things because people just don't know. They just don't know, because then come election time, there's no media. And all it is TV ads from the guys who have the most money. And the guys who have the most money out here are the guys who vote with the oil and gas industry.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, just the actual coverage of it, it makes it an important issue. I mean, that's just the bottom line. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk more about this infrastructure bill, reconciliation, the failure of the voting rights. And we should probably also mention the massive wave of COVID that we're experiencing, particularly in areas of the country that are unvaccinated. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with David Sirota. So, David, in the first segment, we were talking, we touched on the fall of Andrew Cuomo. Very happy to see him go. Feel that there was about 45 other reasons why he could have been both kicked out by law enforcement, frankly, or the voters over the course of the past couple of decades. And we were talking about what we've witnessed in terms of climate change this week and the power of money within obviously all of our politics. And I think for people like us who see the, and I think you had a really excellent metaphor of, you know, the Democratic Party is a blunt spoon. We need a knife. But frankly, you know, it's certainly not the Republican Party. And we got to do the best we can with a blunt spoon at this point because of, the ticking, clock that is, you know, there. Mentioned climate change. So we were talking about this in the context of the eviction moratorium. We are now less than a month away from millions of people losing their unemployment, either, you know, their complete unemployment insurance, the extended unemployment insurance, the employment insurance that is now for gig workers. That was also part of the COVID relief. So there was extra money. There was an expansion of who was eligible. There was extension on the regular unemployment. And so this is going to impact like, I don't know, anywhere from like 7-8 million people. And this is all happening in a beautiful piece of irony on Labor Day, in 2021. And so, with that said, we have the infrastructure bill, the Sinema-Portman bipartisan bill passed with about, I think it was 19 Republican votes. And simultaneously, the Democrats essentially launched the reconciliation bill, which has at this point passed with a budget framework. They've said $3.5 trillion. There's a bunch of sort of amendments that were passed to give instructions to Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders probably will not listen to those instructions from a lot of different people. Knock on wood, thankfully. Give me your sense of what was happening with the infrastructure bill. Like all of this ties together in one big sort of miasma and sort of looming in the background, at least on the infrastructure bill, is the specter of Donald Trump, who I think can marshal a plurality of the Republican Party, but not necessarily the majority of the Republican Party in certain instances. And so it puts the Republicans in a very odd dilemma, and it remains to be seen where the Democrats are in this.
Well, look, I think the process by which they're trying to do this, I mean, it is fraught. I mean, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which doesn't have much, if any, climate stuff in it. I mean, it's got a few things, but it's mostly a sort of standard, non-controversial, at least previously in previous eras, non-controversial road construction, bridges and the like. The idea is that the bipartisan bill has to be attached or come after the reconciliation bill, which is the non-bipartisan, purely Democratic bill with all the stuff, the anti-poverty stuff and the climate change stuff. So what the Republicans want to do and what potentially the conservative Democrats want to do is pass the bipartisan bill and then basically say, you know, enough, goodbye, we're done, right? And the progressive side is saying no climate, no deal. And what they mean on that is we have to pass the reconciliation bill in tandem with or before we're willing to provide the votes to pass the bipartisan bill. You, the Congress, need our votes to probably need our votes in the House and the Senate to pass that bipartisan bill. But we're not going to give up that leverage until you do what we want you to do, which obviously is the climate stuff, which is desperately needed to be done. So it really is in some ways a game of chicken. And whether or not the progressives hold out is really the whole ballgame here. I mean, that really is the whole ballgame. We saw that the progressive members of Congress did not hold out for a $15 minimum wage on Joe Biden's first, the COVID relief bill. They did not hold out. which meant that Biden was not mobilized to force it into the bill and to pressure Democrats to put it into the bill, which means that now $15 minimum wage is gone. It's not in the, by the way, it's not in the new budget reconciliation bill. They claimed it was the parliamentarian, which is anybody who believes that. I've got a reverse mortgage to sell you if you believe that garbage. I mean, it is a whole bunch of garbage. They could have put that in the bill. They could have fired the parliamentarian. They didn't. And they didn't in part because the progressive members of Congress did not hold out. Now they're saying they're going to hold out for climate. Now, that's good. But there and there's a lesson inside of that reconciliation bill about leverage. You will notice that in the reconciliation package, there, as you said, there isn't an extension of jobless benefits, and there isn't the $15 minimum wage. But there is an extension, or there's at least language asking for an extension or an expansion of tax deductions for the so-called SALT tax deductions, which are tax deductions for state and local taxes, which is a very, very regressive form of tax deduction. Most of the benefits go to the top 1%. It's more regressive. One group has found it more regressive than even the Trump tax cuts themselves. That was put into the Democratic reconciliation package because 20 to 30 conservative Democrats in the House said, you will not get our vote for the reconciliation bill unless you put this in. So even though Bernie Sanders said he was opposed to it, he put it in, and you can criticize him, you cannot criticize him, but he looked at the reality of, I can't get the reconciliation bill through because I've got 20 or 30 House Democrats who will not vote for it unless I put it in there. The point is not to cheer on the putting it in there. The point is to say that those conservative Democrats clearly understand leverage, clearly understand how power works. And we're about to see whether the progressive members of Congress are willing to use the same leverage to get done the climate stuff that needs to get done or the planet is doomed.
And what's interesting, I mean, I would draw a distinction, and you tell me if you think this is a fair one. The COVID relief bill was, it seems to me, a bill that really was so tied to the non-$2,000 check, which was a $1,400 check. But to be fair, also include a lot of people who never got the first round of checks, a lot of adult dependents. I mean, there was millions more people who got checks that round, albeit they weren't 2,000. There were 600 before. Regardless, the urgency of passing that COVID relief bill to the average American, I think, was very different than it is in terms of the infrastructure bill. And in terms of the reconciliation, I mean, to progressives, I'm talking your average voter out there. Nobody's talking about this. I mean, to me, $4 trillion of new spending, extending the child tax credit, right? $300 per child for, I don't know, 80% of the American public, and expanding, dropping the age of Medicare eligibility, expanding the Medicare benefits, universal pre-K and community college, and all the Green New Deal, the climate change aspects of this, hugely important as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, even the Republican Party is just like, well, we're just really concerned about critical race theory not being in here. Like, there's no, like, the in other words, the pressure on progressives to pass this and the price they would pay if they sink it seems to me to be much less than it was for the COVID relief bill, right? One is the fire truck is coming. Are you going to stand in the way of the fire truck? The other one is the construction guys are coming here to really make this house. They're going to fix the roof. They're going to fix the plumbing, but they're also going to make it, they're going to, put new siding on and they're going to do some renovation. If you stand in the way of that because they don't show up with the stuff you want, it doesn't have the same impact. And it feels like at least this has been internalized by the Congressional Progressive Caucus. They've already said, Don't send us the infrastructure bill first. Send us the reconciliation bill first, because that's the one that's going to go. What is your take on that? And then I want to talk about what we saw from Joe Manchin moments after the infrastructure, the reconciliation bill passes.
Well, look, I totally agree with you. I think there's a perception that that the progressives can hold out in a stronger way because they will potentially pay less of a price among rank and file voters if the bill ultimately doesn't pass. I think that's the perception. I mean, the flip side is that the more urgently a bill needs to be passed and the more urgent the public perceives the bill that needs to be passed, the more you, I mean, this is just legislative strategy, having worked on the Hill, the more you want to actually put things into that bill because it's a moving train. It's a moving train with a head of steam. And so you try to put stuff in there as much good stuff as you can in there because it's on a moving train that can't stop. Right. So I think it was a missed opportunity at the beginning of Joe Biden's presidency to get $15 onto a moving train. That said, I agree with you. I think, I think that there's a mix of this, that I think progressives felt burned. They felt rolled. They felt, you know, just ignored. A lot of these members of Congress were very new at that time in the year. So I'm not making excuses for them, but like, you know, they just got there and all of a sudden there's this bill 2 weeks later, right? I think now they've got their sea legs, if you will. A lot of these freshman members are there. They understand, they saw themselves get rolled and they know that they won't face nearly the political blowback necessarily among rank and file voters if and when they hold out. Now I'm again, it's a big if they do not hold out, to make sure that the reconciliation bill passes and you in that leverage situation
attacked, yes.
It would be a huge law. It would be epic. I mean, this is really truly is everything because of the climate.
And it's also, I think, the really arguably the last opportunity for any type of meaningful legislation to pass, because if it doesn't happen now, I mean, if there's another reconciliation bite at the apple, which I have very little hope for, regardless of what happens with this bill. But if this bill does not include the things that progressives want in it, it's over.
Right, because now you got an election coming up, a midterm election coming up that's never good for the president's own party. And plus, there's going to probably be gerrymandering because they didn't pass the voting rights bill that needed to pass before the census deadline. The census data is now out, which allows the Republican states to do their own gerrymandering. Yep. So this really is it. So if you're watching this and you are represented by a member of Congress in the Democratic Party, one thing you should be doing is making clear that you are watching to see whether they hold out in a real way on that no climate, no deal pledge.
All right. So we just have about 2 minutes left. Joe Manchin came out, said, I have real concerns about the $3.5 trillion in terms of inflation, which, you know, if that is actually true, there is a cure for that. And that is, if you're worried there's going to be too much money sloshing around in the private sector because of all this government spending, there's a cure for that. And it's called taxation. And that, in fact, is the way that you, under modern monetary theory, you deal with inflation. If there's too much money, you claw some of it back and there's one place where all that money is. And it's not with your average American. It's with, very wealthy people. He hasn't quite stumbled on that solution yet. What do you think he's doing? How real is it? And just about a minute left to go. How real is what Joe Manchin is his issues are?
I think what we've seen a pattern with him is that he kind of fetishizes the idea that he made his mark on a bill. And maybe this is overly hopeful, but that he wants to make some noise, wants to get some news cycles, maybe wants to get a few cuts here and there. But that ultimately, if the progressives do their job, they can build up enough momentum where I don't ultimately believe, maybe in the future I'll be called naive and an idiot, but I don't ultimately believe, if this is played correctly, that Joe Manchin would singularly tank the legislative agenda of his own party's president. I just don't believe he is going to do. Now, we have not seen that theory tested, right? Actually, a lot of things have gone out of their way to not put Joe Manchin in that position of having to decide. And I get the trepidation of it. Maybe he would side with Mitch McConnell and take down Joe Biden's entire legislative agenda, blow up the entire deal, no infrastructure bill, no reconciliation bill. But I just don't think that that's a guarantee that he would do that. I think if it's played correctly, he will go along. He'll make his mark. He'll whine and cry and scream and be annoying. But like, I think ultimately, if this is played correctly, he can be, he won't be the obstructive factor, the singular obstructive factor that he could be.
Well, I think you and I will be both called naive because I'm with you on that. I think what we'll ultimately see is the not the $3.5 trillion bill, but the $3.49 trillion bill. And it's 4.9 because of Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. David Sirota, always a pleasure. I love the Daily Poster. Thank you so much for coming on this week.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Governor Andrew Cuomo is governor no more, or he will no longer be governor. He has finally resigned after a slew of scandals that even predate the one that has officially ousted him, which was mass allegations of sexual harassment and touching of people that he worked with, allegations that were backed up by a report by the New York Attorney General. Here to do a post-mortem of Cuomo's gubernatorial tenure is the wonderful Zephyr Teachout, friend of the show, a professor of law at Fordham University, and author of Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. And you can read her piece on Cuomo in The Nation about his resignation entitled The Real Question is Why Andrew Cuomo Took So Long to Fall. Welcome back to the show, Zephyr.
It's really great to be on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I know, you know, you're on vacation, so I really appreciate you taking the time. But there's nobody better to talk about the fall of Andrew Cuomo than you, given the fact that you ran in a primary against Cuomo and he outspent you a ridiculous amount. And yet you still took a good chunk out of his voter base, because despite the hold he's had over Albany, the progressive wing here in this very blue state of New York has never liked him for good reason. So I guess let's just start there. From a policy perspective, why Cuomo was, I guess, such a bad representation of the Democratic Party in a blue state like New York.
Yeah, I mean, as both myself and Cynthia Nixon, who ran against him in 2018, said time and again, if he had a different last name, you would call him a Republican. I mean, this is somebody who had a Thatcherite, Ronald Reagan-like trickle-down economic theory. Make sure the wealthy donors don't get taxed. But I think, to be frank, the real way to understand his tenure and the fact that he did worse than any sitting incumbent when he ran against me. Also, Cynthia Nixon got another 33-34%. It has to do with that policy, but also with 11 years of scandals. And huge credit to Tish James, Attorney General, for her extraordinary damning report that relied on over 50,000 documents, talked to over 179 witnesses about these 11 victims of Andrew Cuomo's sexual harassment and assault. But it is also important to understand that this is not something that just started recently. Andrew Cuomo has been abusing power since he took office. And he came into office with the shine of Mario Cuomo's name. And I volunteered for him, remembering my admiration for a governor who had come out against the death penalty, Mario Cuomo. And when I ran against him in 2014, you'd run into that all the time. People felt like they knew him because they associated him with Mario Cuomo. But he ran on cleaning up corruption, and he has been a rolling corruption scandal. He set up a commission to investigate corruption, and when it got too close to his donors, he shut it down. We've only just learned from reporting in The New Yorker that after that shutdown, as Preet Bharara began to investigate him, he calls the White House, he calls Obama's White House. And the people on the other end of the line clearly understand that call as saying, do something about these investigations into me. Talk about somebody with no respect for law or legal process. His closest associate, Joe Prococo, is in prison for federal criminal bribery. His signature economic development program, this is somebody who likes to be seen as somebody who gets things done, maybe a bit rough around the edges and a bit tough, but get things done. His signature economic development program, designed to create jobs, created a tiny fraction of the jobs it was supposed to, and instead led to another series of scandals and another associate, Alan Calieros, in prison for federal corruption. And when you look at the individual areas, like you think, what are governors supposed to do, putting aside politics, bridges, roads, sewage systems, schools, just the basic functioning of government? He has, for 11 years, had the most experienced experts quit because they can't bear to work for him because he's a micromanager who thinks he knows better than bridge engineers or transit specialists. The most prominent example of this was Andy Byford quitting the MTA because Cuomo just kept getting in the way. But there's sort of story after story. This is a rolling scandal hiding in plain sight. And I am so grateful for the extraordinary survivors who should never have been put in a position that they were, with somebody so controlling, so vindictive, with so many state resources. I'm so grateful that they came forward and spoke. But we all should really learn from this, that we should never allow somebody who tells you who they are, as Cuomo did for so long, to have that kind of power, because it really damages the state. Right now, New York has the highest level of income inequality of any state. This is not a governor who has left the state in good shape.
Yes. And he spent much of his tenure squashing progressive priorities in a variety of separate ways. But I want to zero in a little bit on the women who came forward as well, yes, because that's so lost in this.
Yeah.
Essentially, you know, part of me wants to focus on, okay, why did it take a harassment and assault scandal for multiple women to get this guy out of there? Because we already know that there was a mass scandal involved with nursing home deaths and an attempted cover-up during COVID. And of course, all of these corruption scandals that you mentioned, I think it says something. One, it says, as you say, a lot about the bravery of the women, and we're incredibly grateful, but because he got away with so much leading up to that point.
Right.
But two, why is this what ousts somebody? Why?
Right.
Why was he not gone after tens of thousands of people died under his watch and he tried to obscure it and hide it? Why did the corruption scandals and the ending of an investigation when it got a little too close to him, why did that not do it? You know, why did it not do it when he tried to squash minimum wage or single payer healthcare? Like, answer that for us. Because as you say in the title of your piece, why did it take Andrew Cuomo so long to fall?
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to math and political math, is that the reason Andrew Cuomo resigned was because he, for the first time, saw that no matter what he said, he was going to be impeached by the Assembly and convicted by the Senate and no longer, and be thrown from office, not on his own terms, and never be able to run for office again. And so this scandal, Andrew Cuomo was not about to resign, no matter how serious the scandal. He only resigned because he saw that he was going to be kicked out and sit. That's really, really clear for anybody who knows Cuomo. So what the feature that allowed this to happen, because you say the scandal brought him down, but let's be clear, these women came forward a while ago. And what actually brought him down was Attorney General Tish James' really thorough, professional, powerful report. And why that's important is because New York's constitutional structure allows for a governor that has incredible amounts of power over the budget process. And so he and other governors have too, but Cuomo really made an art form out of using the budget for revenge, retribution, and reward. So those who might want, who might see what he was doing were terrified that it would directly affect their constituents or affect their reputation. When I ran for governor in 2014, two of the groups that supported me, their leaders lost their job within 4 months. And he made it very clear, and he wanted everybody to know that too. So if you support my rival, you will be gone. So, but this is why what Tish James did was so important, because the one check in New York's constitutional system is that you do have an attorney general who also has executive and investigative powers. And so Attorney General James using those powers and showing real leadership, validating the wholly credible stories of these women who'd come forward with a very thorough investigation was really essential. The scandal alone didn't do it. It was the report and the numbers that changed things. And Emma, one thing that is sort of really heartening is part of what happened here is grassroots organizing led to electing new people in the New York State Senate and new people in the New York State Assembly who were no longer scared of Cuomo. And so if you sort of step back, it is a shift, not because of new scandals, but because of a new power alignment. And it just shows you how important elections are. You have the same scandals and a different election cycle. Andrew Cuomo is still governor, is still abusing women, is still using state power, state resources to enrich himself, getting a $5 million book deal this last year, using state resources. I mean, it's, I was just talking to a friend about how there's a combined feeling of relief because the people of New York deserve so much better. And like some genuine anger at all the people who were part of covering up and protecting Cuomo for years.
Yeah, and you mentioned the elections and how they matter. One, your election laid a lot of the groundwork. And then what built on it too, I think, was the spotlight that Ocasio-Cortez's race brought to New York, which then parlayed into Cynthia Nixon's race, which helped, you know, but Cynthia Nixon did not win, but the state senators and the state representatives who are members of the assembly who ran, they were buoyed by a lot of the attention. Yeah. And so it just goes to show that even if races aren't won, you know, I think about Charles Booker's race in Kentucky, right? Like that lays a groundwork and an infrastructure for something greater. And you know, this is when I should be asking a question, but I just opine for a bit. We have to take a quick break, but we'll build on this when we get back. So before we broke, we were talking a little bit about how the structure of the state Senate and the state assembly changed so radically, which allowed for this to happen because Cuomo would not have resigned if he didn't know he was going to be impeached by these very members. The IDC, a lot of people may not be aware of what this was and why this was such an important strategic ally, this group of people in the IDC that Cuomo relied on. And why their elimination and ending was so important to this actually happening. Talk a little bit about that, if you could.
Thank you for bringing it up. Because so many people nationally know Cuomo from you know, his dad, and then briefings during COVID, and then this scandal. Andrew Cuomo, this is one of these Ripley believe it or not. Andrew Cuomo actively propped up a group of Democrats who were elected as Democrats and ran as Democrats in blue districts to instead caucus with and vote with Republicans in New York State so that Republicans had a veto on all legislation. This is true. And this was true from the beginning of his governorship. It was a key reason I ran against him in 2014. And he promised the Working Families Party that he would dissolve this group of, again, running with a D, voting with the R's in New York, blue New York.
And they got perks from that. They got bigger offices. Like that's he favored them in order to be a roadblock for the progressives in the very blue state, so he wouldn't have to take tough votes, basically.
Right. So then he would say, I support campaign finance reform. Nothing I can do about it because the Republicans keep blocking it. Having himself created that block, he would say he supported a full reproductive freedom agenda and then say, yeah, but the Republicans keep blocking it. The Republicans who he put in power. It was a insidious, really harmful structure. And so the key elections that you're talking about, Emma, is the year that New Yorkers got rid of the IVC 8 years into Andrew Cuomo's tenure, with a series of local primary challenges that the betting markets would tell you were not likely to win. It really was a show of hope and honesty and amazing candidates. And these candidates just then came in without owing chits to the machine and with a real understanding of the harm that is caused when you're dishonest with your constituents. And having said that, they're really brave when they spoke up in the last few years. You know, state lawmakers who spoke up against Cuomo would get totally shut out, and it would affect their, you know, it affects their constituents. He used his staffers publicly insulted state senators using really vulgar language.
Ron Kim, was very aggressive in calling out the nursing home scandal, and he was threatened by Cuomo personally, according to his account. But I believe him.
He was threatened by Cuomo, and it was very clear that Cuomo was out to destroy his reputation. What Ron said is, he said, "I will destroy you." And any reporter who is used to the yelling of Andrew Cuomo on the other side of the phone, which was a signature feature of his tenure, heard that. So Ron was an extraordinary hero in speaking up about the fact that people were dying in nursing homes, asking questions about it. And after these questions were raised by Ron Kim, Senator Biagi, and others, Cuomo lied about the actual number of people who were in who died in nursing homes. After granting immunity to hospital executives and nursing home executives, and then later lied about why he lied. And in retrospect, if you look at the timeline, it is so clear and so banal and disgusting, but he lied so that his numbers would look good, so he'd get a $5 million book deal. This is pandemic profiteering, making millions of dollars off of lying about people's deaths. It makes me sick with rage.
and I feel your passion, and I share it, you know.
And but when Ron spoke up, he did so at great risk, because Cuomo punishes. He doesn't just punish in by slandering people's reputations. He does everything that he can to make sure they're shut out of every other conversation.
Right. And so much of what you describe, it reminds me of Trump, right? And people who may be watching or listening to this who don't live in New York may be thinking the same thing, right? The son of somebody who was prominent, living in his father's shadow, who is a bully, who lies, who obscures numbers in the pandemic in order to make oneself look better, and who bullies, who screams, who berates, who sexually harasses women. I mean, I guess just talk about that dynamic. I mean, what that says about our Democratic Party, that we're both, you know, we're both Democrats, progressives, the milestone that is to oust somebody who exhibits so many of the values that we despised in the president of the United States that has, like, you know, who wreaked havoc over the country for 4 years.
It took way too long. But I am so proud of our party, my party, the Democratic Party. Leaders of the Democratic Party for saying, no, just having being a Democrat does not mean you get a pass for this behavior. And I think what we should learn is that we as Democrats thrive. We aren't hurt by calling out real corruption and harassment and abuse within our own party, which will happen. We actually can only thrive when we do it. And that Andrew Cuomo, being so prominently attached to the Democratic Party, was not helping the Democratic Party, but holding back the thriving of New York, holding back the possibilities of New York because of his selfish power grabs. And so next time you see this, when somebody tells you who they are by a series of corruption scandals, by being just routinely dismissive of women. He never even has said my name as far as we know in public. He refused
really?
To shake my hand. He called wow. it a really decorated reporter, an extraordinary Albany area reporter who asked him about sexual harassment issues 4 years ago. He said her question was a disservice to women and he got angry about it.
Oh, well, by the way, we should just say it was an open secret that he was verbally abusive to reporters, yeah. to staff, to yeah. people. I mean, people I know that are Cuomo supporters, yeah. I would say this.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I, you know, people had different ways of understanding. Some people were quiet because of self-protection. Other people, though, were quiet because they just said, that's just the way it is. You know, that's how people who get things done act. That's how power works. I got to tell you, the man's bridges are unsafe. If you have somebody who is corrupt and abusive in one area, do you think the engineers are going to speak up and make sure that you have safe bridges? No. So
yeah.
you need to, basically, we need to learn from this, that we do not allow these kinds of abuses because they hurt people and they certainly hurt the party. And again, I'm proud of the party for getting there. I wish the Republican Party would do the same thing with it, with, yeah. With its own abusers.
Well, fat chance with that. I mean, like good luck. It seems to be part parcel and of their kind of ideology about things. But I want to touch on this before we have to go about his infrastructure, because people don't realize that, you know, you'll hear all the time, maybe on the New York Post or about how gross the subways are and how dilapidated they are. And, you know, from a progressive perspective, how inaccessible they are for handicapable people, people who, may not be able to walk downstairs, et cetera. There are a ton of problems, but that is yeah. run by Cuomo. That is not yes. run by de Blasio, and de Blasio has his own issues, but like there's massive school problems that you can, draw back to Cuomo. The infrastructure, as you mentioned, being poorly made, you can draw back to Cuomo. Sewer systems, etc. Talk about that legacy yes. of his.
Yeah. So, you know, already in 2014, it was clear that Cuomo used the MTA basically as a piggy bank, you know, as his ATM. So ways to take money from the state money that is committed to public transportation. And instead of using that money that was much needed, shifted away towards his own projects. And his biggest project was making sure that rich people don't pay taxes, which is one of the reasons we have such radical inequality in New York. And I mean, this is just an embarrassment. You have New York City with subways that are billions of dollars short on repair that are not state-of-the-art subways. These are 1990 subways in 10 to 20 years behind on being kept up. And when he did put money into it, it was often for superficial changes, not for the key changes that were needed.
So or for changes that only affected Manhattan, or, you know, let's put more cops too in the subway system so we can crack down on turnstile jumpers.
And he's always about headlines, not about the real work. The real work is hard. It's not, you may not be wearing a cape when it happens. He liked to be out there in snowstorms and act like a person of action. But when you actually look at the sort of the physical shape of the transportation system that he was responsible for, He had these extraordinary people quit because they couldn't work with him. But it's an embarrassment. And it just shows that he was never, he was always about the presentation, about using fear to shut up opponents, presenting as a hero, but allowing the infrastructure, and I include an infrastructure, public education, to be profoundly neglected.
Yes. I mean, it's very apt to be talking about this when we're in the middle of this infrastructure fight. Absolutely. On the federal level.
I think of it as, you know, it's the corruption, the word corruption to rupt. I don't speak Latin. I don't know Latin, but I happen to know this as a student of corruption, that a ruptere is to break apart, and corruptere, you know, corruption is to break apart from within. And so this is a governor whose tenure was defined by corruption, you know, corruption scandals, but also the literal corrosion and corruption of the physical elements of the state, the water systems, the sewage systems. And there is an investigation now into the safety of the bridges that he saw as his pet projects.
Right. Very lastly here, just emphasize the opportunity to elect somebody different. Again, 11 years of Andrew Cuomo, and before him, you know, Spitzer obviously mired by scandal, but we haven't really had a barn burning progressive in this very blue state. So
right, and we have a very progressive state. We've had basically a politics that's C-, and a public that is an A. You know what? Not to be grading everybody, but we need a politics
very professorial of you.
Yes, right. Worthy of our state. And there's a huge moment now. Because you've had now over the last 6 years, really from 2014 on, so many amazing, dynamic, creative, powerful progressives. I'll lift somebody up who's not about to be running for governor, but who is just so exciting. The new borough president of Brooklyn, Antonio Reynoso, who was leading on those nitty gritty issues that get left behind by Cuomo, like how to do waste, how to have to, on a local level, impact climate change with better infrastructure. We have amazing, big dreaming, big hearted progressives at so many different positions in the Senate, in the Assembly. And so we have a moment in New York to show what great progressive leadership looks like. Now, the bare minimum is to have a leader who isn't corrupt, doesn't use fear, and doesn't sexually assault and harass their employees. But we should not settle for the bare minimum. We should say, yeah, that's a baseline. But like, let's take this exciting moment in New York with AOC and new leaders across the state, and Jamal Bowman and Mondaire Jones. And, you know, we have so many exciting federal leaders, and like, let's be at home in New York. Now, to me, the next governor really matters, but honestly, a lot rests on the legislature, because so much of what has gone wrong over the last 11 years is, and frankly, more than 11 years back to prior governors, is that we've had a top heavy governing scheme in New York, where the governor controls the budget, the governor controls the appointments, and having the Assembly and the Senate lead on the budget, lead on reform, that's actually my vision. It's stop looking for heroes and start looking for local power built up for collective democratic governance.
Absolutely. Well, Zephyr Teachout, she's a professor of law at Fordham University. Her book is called Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. She's great. Please read her book and check out her work. Zephyr, thank you so much for your time today. I couldn't have picked somebody better to speak on this topic for the show.
Great to talk to you. Thanks.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Support the show by becoming a member. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And you can check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day and also in-depth interviews. You can find Emma and I on the Peacock app as well. Check us out at 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. daily. For Emma Vigeland, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.